You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Quinn, are you okay?
I'm fine.
I have to tell you, Justina's here. My friend is visiting me in Florida.
In the room? Guess what?
No. She came here on Tuesday. She got the flu. She's been sick all week.
It's not my favorite thing.
I can't imagine it would be. I don't know that it is the flu.
It's just I've never had a cold that had this sticking power.
Like, oh, it's bub.
Highly aggressive. And I got sick Tuesday night. It's Saturday.
Yeah.
And I'm just like,
were you and Justine in the same place?
Everyone in New York has it. Like, in a way where, I don't know if you were on the email. You must have been on the email for Jamie's.
No.
Okay. Jamie, why were you not on the email?
What email?
Oh, he must have known. He must have asked me if you were in town.
What?
Are you really not on this email? Yeah, you're really not.
Wait, what is this?
Okay. Jamie Cummings had
I was on that email.
For some reason, I was thinking of like... Oh my God, I just got... For some reason, I was thinking of like Jamila. Like, I didn't know which Jamie. I was like, there's a couple Jamies. Like, was it Jamie Lowe, like, who does our amazing Instagram? I was like, who... Which Jamie?
But you're not on it. Where are you?
I was on it. But people were dropping like flies last night, weren't they?
Yes. People were like, dropping like flies.
Everybody is sick.
But I went.
Quinn Posner, you fucking super.
I told everybody.
Spreader,
I was like, I told everybody. I was like, I'm really sick and I'm coming. And I brought Jamie a cake.
That you coughed in.
And I
it's
put
a coffin cake.
I put he was turning 54 and I didn't have a 5 and a 4. I have candy numbers in my house and I found the candy 6 and a candy 7. So I just did 67. And then we sang up. I was like, you're 54.
You didn't 54. Even want to save like, a 6 or a 7 for when Griff turns 6 or 7? Wow.
No.
Sacrifices were made.
I know.
I hope Jamie felt fucking loved. Because your ass, you know, you're going to have to find another creative endeavor to put 6 or 7 on Griff Dog's cake. That's just it.
He felt loved. He had a great birthday. It was so sweet. It was such a trip down memory lane, and it was so many of us. And Alex came. Dear readers, Carrie and I used to work.
Oh, my God.
At an immersive show that ended at a bar. And the bartender that was typically there, Alex, who is now working as a plumber in the Bronx, or actually he's working in the city. He lives in the Bronx. But he was great, and he came, and he was like, and he bought me a drink, and we hung out for a while and caught up, and it was so good to see him. And
he was truly like, he's maybe the person, because we don't see a lot of the people we try to see, and mm-hmm. Alex is not, but he truly like was the nicest, best person to be around, like truly just the most amazing person. And yeah. I bet he's the same still amazing person.
Yeah, it was just so good to see him. We were cracking each other up and telling stories. And there was this guy that was the porter of the bar, Victor. Do you remember Victor? And he used to clean and listen to that
Victor.
Intense heavy metal.
Victor was my guy.
He wasn't heavy metal. It was like
No, it was death metal. Death it was like metal. it was death metal.
I was like, and I know it has a word. It he was so intense.
It was so intense, and it'd be like, like that guttural of a sound. But you'd see him, and he would just be like, he was always so happy, mm-hmm. and like he.
So he lost his job there, and I was like, "Is he okay?" And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, he's working with old people." And I was like, "Tell me about that." And he's like,
"He'd
yeah,
be great."
He like comes to their house and like. Like helps them and like plays games with them, like does crossword, whatever. And it's like he goes to the movies with them. And I was laughing. I was like, you know, it'd be so perfect if they paired him with a deaf older person so that he could play the music he likes. And it would be such an amazing visual to have like him and an old person in a car. And he's playing that blow your ears out death metal while they like drive to go see a movie. Like,
ugh, anyway, I love that.
It was really sweet. And we talked about, this is interesting. Jamie went to Disneyland with his kids. So we're talking about that.
LA, not Orlando.
No, Florida. He went to Disney World.
Disney World. Sorry. Okay. I just, please use the correct Christian name.
No, the reason
for
I'm
the park.
I'm so sorry. I forget you're a Disney
you.
Adult.
Disney adult over here. Calling for duty.
So what was crazy was, I was like, was it great? And he's like, yeah, it was really great. You know what was better? And I'm like, what? And he's like, the month before I went to Disneyland, but just with a friend for his 50th and some of his friends, just adults. And his friend has that elite membership status, Club 33 or whatever.
What?
So they don't wait in lines and they go to private secret restaurants that are behind like secret doors, like speakeasy style.
That's it.
That the rest of the park can't access.
Quinn, maybe I need to be a Disney adult just to get that access.
I was like, this is crazy. And he goes, yeah, it was really hard to go back to a Disney park after having done it that way. Because you're like, I know that there are secret doors everywhere. And now I'm just with the common folk and I'm not allowed.
And I'm not allowed. And I know they're
and
there.
I'm with my kids.
I know they're there. Yeah. That's insane. I mean, wow. Okay. Maybe I do need to be a Disney. Also, when you're with your kids, you can't get like drunk or you can't do any of that. You know, like you're also like sitting down for dinner and it's like to fuel up and to make sure your kids don't have a meltdown. It's not to be like, what do I want to eat here at this beautiful little restaurant? I think they're different vibes.
Well, so we met, you know, at Madame X, which has such a particular vibe. But I have to tell you, because this will be maybe boring to everyone else but you, but they redid the bar completely. So
what?
When you walk it downstairs, the bar is on the opposite side of the wall from where it used to be.
Oh, I don't like that.
You
I don't
would.
Like that.
It's way better.
It's way better.
It's crazy. It's like so much more space. And the bathrooms they redid so that they're next to each other and the woman's isn't like a really long hallway bathroom. It's regular. But in a way where now there's a huge dance floor essentially. Like now you
okay,
walk in and there's
like
a ton of room to dance. And they have constantly a fog machine going, which is so weird and fun.
Was there
and
a cover to get in?
We met the new people that are running it. And they're really – they're like a very sweet couple, and it was just so different to have the bar that way that Freddie was meeting us and he walked downstairs and then left. He was like, this is the wrong place.
The
and then he was
is,
like
the like
I think it could have been the right place. Like
the trashiness of it was
all the
so
same
endearing
furniture.
No, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The things, okay, so Quinn and I were working an immersive show. That's how we met. That's our meet cute. Well, I auditioned for her. It's fun. I like literally auditioned to be Quinn's friend. Got it. Booked
the gig.
Got the gig. Made fun of myself in the audition. And they were like, yeah, she can hang. So then, no, I think what it was is I talked about how big my boobs were. And then the person in charge really liked that, which is kind of a weird vibe. Anyway, the best thing about it is that, oh, wait, there was something I wanted to say that I forgot. Oh, so we were doing an immersive show, and this show was for all ages. Like, it didn't, you know, I mean, obviously babies probably wouldn't get a lot of it, but like families would come through and we'd be working until like 4 or 5 o'clock. And then like suddenly, like we were the day shift and then the night shift took over and this place could be rented out upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so there were dancers that would come in and they would be, you know, exotic dancers, like strippers, whatever. But somebody would have like rented out the top room. And so we'd be like with these like little families and then these beautiful women would come in and like disrobe and get ready for like lap dances upstairs. And like, meanwhile, Koa was like just born and someone would be like watching him upstairs while these dancers would come in and start like putting on makeup, getting their amazing heels on. Like, it was a, what a vibe.
Was like crawling around a floor with like broken glass and used condoms. Like, it was very, it was a very intense atmosphere for him to be raised in. And I was like doing, we were talking about it last night, like what a weird childhood he had, where like I would schedule it so that Matt played an early role in the immersive show and I played a late role. So our call times were different. Matt would get to work. I'd bring Koa with me when I went to work. And if I'd either play a role that I wrote to have a baby and I would like be with him playing that role, which on his 1-year-old birthday, I remembered I was playing that role. And it's a role that didn't play, take place at the bar. It took place on a street corner near Wall Street. And there was a fountain that came out of the ground. The kind that like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like flush with the ground. It's not.
Yeah.
And I remember for his 1-year-old birthday, I brought his swimsuit and put him in his swimsuit and he couldn't walk. He was still crawling and he was doing an army crawl. He didn't even crawl normal. And I let him crawl around the ground in Manhattan over this fountain that he liked. And people were looking at me like there was like a cigarette in the fountain. You know what I mean? It was like people were like, what is wrong? This woman is crazy. I'm so surprised CPS didn't get called.
And the nice thing is that the role, you were supposed to play a crazy person. So it all sort of like really worked out well in your favor.
But it was insane because I was like, that's how he spent his 1-year-old birthday. But anyway, or we'd go to the bar and I'd be playing a role downstairs and I'd pay a stage manager to babysit Koa upstairs. I'd go up and breastfeed between groups that we were performing for. And then at the end of the day, Matt would come back to the bar. He'd already be done. I'd still be working. He'd take Koa home. And it was, and then I'd like finish my gig, pump at the bar upstairs next to the exotic dancers and be like, hey, and then I'd go home. Like,
nice tits.
Yeah. The, everyone had their tits out.
Everybody had their
tits. Mine were like, drooping.
Yours,
and getting
yours
milked.
Were pumping milk. Theirs were just getting perked up and ready to go. I mean, I think the best is I'm so glad I never had a black light on any of those couches because you'd come in from like a day and the night after, the day, morning after, and you'd be like, this place has seen some things.
For sure.
This
for
place sure. has seen. If these walls could talk, they would have signed an NDA because it would not have been appropriate for anyone.
Well, you
involved.
Know, there's always like creeps that come. So, dear
oh
readers,
my God, yeah.
the vibe of the place is that it's like boudoir-y. So it's obviously it's called Madame X. It's got like red velvet.
It's
and
like
when you look
leopard
at it from the
rugs.
Outside, the sign will say things like everyone here is sexy tonight. Like something like very provocative on the sign. That's what it
Quinn,
said.
That was that's a lame provocative.
Carrie, everyone I believe that's exactly what it said last night.
Sorry.
I'm
Think
not
about,
being creative.
I know you're not being creative, but I'm obsessed with the idea of like, you know, it'd say things provocative, like everyone here is sexy, which, ooh.
It did say
ooh.
That last night. So anyway, what ends up happening when we worked there was there'd always be guys that would come and they'd think they weren't sure if it was like an illegal brothel was the vibe of them. So
yes.
they'd walk in alone. Yes. And they wouldn't go to the bar in order. They'd case the joint. They'd like walk all through the bar kind of looking. And I'd be back there with like another actress and maybe two young stage managers, like gals in their early 20s.
With munchkins with like donut holes.
And like weird props. And they would be like, hey, do you work here? And they're like trying to get a sense of like, am I about to order one of you and go upstairs? And we'd be like, no, that's not what's about to happen. We're performing here, and no, this is a bar.
This
if you want a bar, if you want a drink, go to the bar and order a drink. This is a bar, and we'd have to be like really firm with them about expectations because
no, you shall not pass. It's like a little bit of that vibe.
Exactly. Okay, so last night we're there, and it's and one of those types walks in, a guy in a puff coat. Walks into the back room and does the walk and he's like looking at me, looking at Grace, like has like a vibe. And I turned to Grace and Matt and I said, check out this creep. And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, I know like exactly what's going through
him.
This guy's mind. He's here. He's trying to gauge the room. He's trying to see if anyone here would fuck him. and he's not going to necessarily, he's going to like lurk and lurk on different groups and be a weirdo. And Matt, I could tell, was like giving me this face like, you're such a bitch. Like you always have, you always think everybody's like out to get you. Anyway, so then the woman that now owns the bar starts talking to a group of us about it. And we're all asking questions because we all have like a history with it. And he kind of has that physical presence where he's like lurking. Mm-hmm. And I was like, get out of here. Like, ugh. Like it just makes me, that kind of stuff makes me crazy. So anyway, then I go to the bar to get a drink for Matt. And I'm at the bar and, oh my God, and you'll love this story. The woman behind the bar is wearing like super, super scantily clad, like dark, dark makeup, like earrings, tattoos.
She's looking hot.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm like, you look, she looked tired as hell. And she was like, she like did a shot. And then I was like, cheers. And she's like, and I said, you look tired. And she goes, I'm at Columbia for criminal, law, and I'm just so tired, but like, and I'm like, oh, you have to go all the way uptown? And she's like, yeah, but you know, I really want Columbia on the resume. I really think it's going to make a difference in what kind of jobs I can get. And it was just such a New York moment where you like might make a judgment about a person and how they look and how they're presenting. And here's this woman, like black lace, scantily clad, working at Madam X, and she's working to pay the bills so she can get her criminal law degree at Columbia. I was just like, you're amazing. Like,
this is why New York rules, man. Yes. This is why fucking New York rules.
And we had such a great conversation. And then guess who comes up to interrupt it?
The Puffy creep. Coat.
The fucking creep.
Let's just call him Puff Daddy.
And he so aggressively is like, hi, I'm Brian. What's your name? And I'm like, Quinn. And he's like, are you from around here? And I was like, no. Like, you know, one syllable answers.
Yes.
Didn't even give him a Quinlan, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like,
he doesn't know you like that.
Where are you from? And I was like, Denver. And he's like, oh, I'm from New Jersey and I'm just here alone for the night looking for a company.
Quit.
And I go,
what part of you? Like, what?
No joke.
Did you look hot last night or what?
No joke. I was like, oh man, I'm like definitely gave you.
I gave you no opening.
Such specific fuck off energy. I can't believe that this is who you're approaching. Like, so I said, weird. I go, weird. I'm here with a group of friends that I really miss, just trying to catch up with them. And the bartender, like, kind of like, there was another bartender, a guy, and he was like trying not to laugh. And then I like turned my body away. So he walked away. And then I looked at the bartender and I was like, was that rude? And he goes, no, that was perfect. And a place like this, you have to be very direct. And I was like, yes, exactly. You have to just shut it down instantly.
That is Madam X. There was a role that I played when I was there where it was Bunny. That was the name. And she was, you know, a mafiosa's girlfriend. And so there was a long time where I wore like a tight gold mini skirt and this like faux fur blue. And I'd be at the bar like pretending to get drunk. And like half the time the group would come and they would see me and I was very obvious. But when it got later in the day, you'd get these like guys coming in. And I got to tell you, I did look very open because I was open for business in that I was like trying to get the group to find me, you know, so you
so
do
you're
have
sitting
to have,
at
like,
the bar alone, like doing weird poses.
Yeah. And you're like, and you're talking and like, and I'm loud. And so sometimes like a group of guys would come in and we don't know what the groups look like. So I'm like, oh, this is the group. And it'd just be like some frat boys. And I'd be like, oh shit, I read this wrong. And then I'd be like, guys, don't talk to me. I'm an actor. Please leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was such a hard thing to navigate. Yeah, it was such a wild thing, but it was really funny to be there last night and really like special to get to be with all the people we used to. I mean, everyone showed up, you know?
I love that. I'm sad I wasn't there. I'm sad I wasn't there to support Jamie, but I hope he felt loved and it was a really good birthday for him.
He really did. It got him that 67 cake. He was so happy.
By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily. I'm Carrie Ipama.
I'm Quinlan Posner. We
and
have
she's
no
sick.
New subscribers.
Okay, okay. I'm going to tell you a story.
I can't wait to hear your flip-flop and story.
I'm excited to tell you this story. I got this information from history.com, a lot of Wikipedia, some Vice, Time. I'm going to tell you a story about some gals. This is Freddie Nanda Decker Overstegen. She's born in 1925.
That's one name?
That's one name.
Okay.
Freddie Nanda Decker Overstegen. And I'm not saying right. This is a Dutch name. And I should know because, like these women, I am Dutch. That is my background.
You're freaky deaky Dutch?
You ain't much if you ain't Dutch is what the family calls it.
Don't you love in, is it Austin Powers when Michael Caine is
God,
like, there's
I'm
nothing
God.
I hate more than, he says, there's nothing I hate more than intolerance. And the Dutch.
The Dutch are... See, here's the thing. The Dutch, it's really interesting, right? Because on one hand, you know, colonizers, man. The Dutch were fucking taking over everything. In fact, I remember I was doing in college, I was working with a Femi Oshofi-san, who's a Nigerian playwright. And he came to Indiana and did, like, a workshop. It was amazing, where he taught Nigerian theater and what that looked like and how it was totally different from what we see as theater. And so we got to participate. And I remember auditioning for Femi and he was like, Ipama, is that African? And I like laughed because I'm very, very, very white. And I mean, it could have been, but anyway, I was like, no.
Never
like,
been asked that.
Never been asked that. And then it was later that I realized how, like, actually it was my ignorance because, of course, a Dutch name might sound African because the Dutch colonized Africa. Like, uh-huh. A lot of South Africans, I think, are Dutch. Like, there's just, it's not good. It's not something to be proud of. Also, in New York, like New Amsterdam. In fact, a lot of these girls that I'm going to talk about, they were in Harlem, H-A-A-R-L-E-M, which I think is also, like, a Dutch colony. So Dutch colonizers, not good. But I want to talk about some heroes, which is Freddie Nanda Decker Overstegen. She's born in 1925, and she has an older sister, Truus Menger Overstegen. And her older sister is born in 1923. And the two of them, they live in the Netherlands with their family. In fact, for the first part of their life, they live on a barge. And, like, I think their family has always been a bit politically minded. In fact, before the war, which, Quinn, as you know, is World War...
Which war?
But 1939. World War
Two.
Nailed it. 1939 is World War Two.
Hey, and it was before, a 50-50 chance.
It was a 50-50. And you're going to learn some history today. And I'm, well, we're on the brink of World War Three, but I do think that this is an important story to cover, and you'll see why. So before the Second World War, they actually hid people from Lithuania in the hold of their ship. So I think their family was very much like politically minded or humanity minded. I guess their parent relationship wasn't very strong, in fact, because her mother ended up divorcing her husband, the father of the girls. And so the two, so once they divorced, they moved in and they were raised by their mom. In fact, they said that it was an amicable divorce and it was pretty rare at the time to get divorced from your husband. But apparently their dad, like, saying I love you on the tip of their ship. What is the thing I'm thinking of? On the stern, on the hull.
Titanic.
On the Titanic. But apparently he like sang them a love song and then left. And then they're like, and then we really didn't see him again because my mom didn't want to be around. Go off. So then they moved to a small apartment from the barge. Their mom ends up getting remarried. She has a son. So the girls have a half brother. They are not rich by any means. They live in poverty. But I think they're just like, they're getting by. World War II begins in 1939. It's important to know that the Dutch maintained neutrality from the beginning, right? They did not pick a side. That being said, just because your government doesn't pick a side doesn't mean that the citizens will always adhere to that. Mm-hmm. And the Overstegens, the two girls and the family, they were very much on the side, on the Allies. So they would hide, like, I remember she recalls them hiding, like, a young, like, a Jewish couple in their home. And the girls themselves, at the age of 14 and 16, they became really active in the anti-Nazi movement. They would hand out anti-Nazi pamphlets, which attracted the commander of the Council of Resistance, which is the resistance movement within Holland, within the Netherlands. And so this guy sees these young girls handing out pamphlets, and he sees that they're politically minded, that they're resisting, you know, Germany at this point. And so this guy with a hat comes to their mom's door, knocks on it, and is like, "Hey, do you mind if these two girls join the resistance? We think they'll be really good because no one will suspect them because they're teenage girls." And their mom was like, "Okay."
Wow. Sure. She's casual.
Yeah. So they like started to get trained by the resistance. And they end up meeting this gal, Hanny Shaft. She's a bit older than the girls. So she's like 18, but she's also in the resistance. Hanny apparently was her secret name in the resistance, but that's what we'll refer to as. So we have Freddie, Truce, and Hanny. At the time, Hanny was studying to be a human rights lawyer when the war began. She was smart. She was an intellectual. She was always very politically minded. She was a member of the communist movement, but she always discussed politics and social justice from a very young age. Truce, the older of the two sisters, she was pretty down to earth, a natural leader, very decisive. And Freddie, she's very feminine, but she was fierce. She was a planner, and she would map out their missions. So during the war, the three of them worked for the Dutch resistance, and this became all the more imperative when Germany occupied the Netherlands. So while the Netherlands was neutral, the Germans invaded them in 1940, and it took 5 days for the Dutch to be like, "All right, you got it. We don't want to fight. We don't want to lose people." Mm-hmm. And the Dutch government and royal family relocated to London, but that meant that the Netherlands were occupied by Germany. So between 1940 and 1941, it was a gentle occupation, which is, they called it something like the velvet touch or velvet occupation, which is like, we're just going to like come in, we're taking over, we're not going to be like dicks about it. But because at this time, the Germans couldn't help but be dicks, it escalated. So in 1941 to 1944, there was a massive decline in living conditions. I'm just outlining sort of like what was happening in the Netherlands, so you're aware, where that's when they start deporting the country's Jewish population to concentration camps. So mm-hmm. as we all know, Anne Frank, a very famous young girl from Amsterdam, had to hide to evade capture by these Nazi troops. What's interesting and worth noting is that 70% of the country's Jewish population in the Netherlands was killed during World War II, which is much higher than Belgium and France, which both of those were occupied by Nazi forces. The Germans paid a bounty to Dutch police and administration officials to locate and identify Jewish people. The communists of the Netherlands organized a February strike as early as 1941, a general strike to protest against the persecution of Jewish citizens. So the Communist Party was very active against Nazism and against the horrible treatment of Jewish people in the Netherlands. So in 1944 to 1945, which we know the war will end in 1945, but again, this is worth noting, is the conditions completely deteriorated. So while the Germans were fighting on multiple fronts, the Netherlands suffered from starvation and lack of fuel. Interestingly enough, I saw a show, a friend of mine had a show about her grandparents who lived in the Netherlands during the German occupation in 1944 through the World War II. And they talk about the famine, and it was known as the winter hunger or hunger winter. And essentially it was people just didn't have any food because as the Germans were occupying, no one was delivering food. The Germans were not taking care of them. And I think this is worth noting because it was in her show and I find it fascinating, is that people who deal with famine and starvation, there is a correlation between disordered eating generations after, which I think is a very interesting fact. Whereas you have, whether it's a grandparent or a great-grandparent who starts to hold on and not waste food, whether it's like a little nub of something in tinfoil in a freezer, like you're not throwing out anything because your body remembers, and then their children and grandchildren
inherit that.
will inherit that fear, and also, and it will manifest in disordered eating, which mm-hmm. I think is absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I mean, trauma like this is not just one generation. It continues for many.
It's so incredible that it does that. It's so true, though.
This is what's happening in the Netherlands when Freddy Truce and Hanny are there. The three of them were working for the resistance during this time. And so they would steal information from officers. They would help connect Jewish children with safe houses. They would smuggle Jewish children out of the country. They would help Jewish children escape concentration camps. They stole ID papers. In fact, Hanny actually would steal cards from her friends or Jewish residents so that they could not be identified as Jewish. Hanny then became fluent in German, and so then she can communicate with officers. The three of them, teenagers at this time, they also would blow shit up. They bombed railways. They bombed bridges with dynamites to affect travel. And they also killed German soldiers. So Freddie, who is the youngest, 14 with the war, when the war began. So she was 19 by the time the war ended. But she was the first, I guess, between the three of them to kill someone. So Freddie, when she was riding her bike one day, she remembers pulling out a gun and shooting a German soldier. Mm-hmm. Just like, done. And I'm going to read a quote from her. "While I was biking, I saw Germans picking up innocent people from the streets, putting them against a wall and shooting them. I was forced to watch, which aroused such an enormous anger in me, such a disgust, a feeling of dirty bastards. You can have any political conviction or be totally against war, but at that moment you are just a human being confronted with something very cruel. Shooting innocent people is murder. If you experience something like this, you'll find it justified to act against it. Once I was confronted with an SS soldier, a Dutch SS soldier even, who was killing a small baby by hitting it against a wall. He grabbed the baby and hit it against the wall. The father and sister had to watch. They were obviously hysterical. The child was dead. I shot that guy. Right there and then. That wasn't an assignment, but I don't regret it."
Oof.
It's very heavy. One of the things, why I started researching this story was also because the three women would use their feminine wiles, and they would seduce high-ranking Nazi officials, mm-hmm. Nazi officers, and they would lure them into the woods under the pretense of some romance. So they would go up to a soldier, and they'd ask them if they wanted to have a stroll in the forest, wink, wink. And once they were there, either they would kill the soldiers, or someone on the resistance would be there waiting for them to shoot them. Of the three, Hanny became an icon of the Dutch resistance. She was known as the girl with the red hair, and she was placed on the Nazis' most wanted list. And she did talk about how she did not accept every assignment the resistance gave her, which I think was interesting. Obviously, they sacrificed so much, and they had, you know, they were killing people. But at one point, she was asked to kidnap children of the Nazi officials, and she just refused.
Yeah.
She said if the plans,
you can draw a line. I mean,
you can draw a line. And she was like, if the plan had failed, she said, if the plan had failed, the children would have been killed. And she felt that that was too similar to the Nazis' acts of terror.
Yeah.
In 1944, she and some colleagues in the resistance were going through an assassination of a Dutch police officer and collaborator. And while they were killing this guy, her friend was shot in the process. It was a fatal wound. He was taken to the hospital. And while he was in the hospital, this woman came up to him and she said she was with the resistance. She was a resistance worker. And he gave her Hanny's name and address. And lo and behold, she was not a resistance worker. She was working for the Nazis. And so they were able to capture Hanny. And they tried to get her to confess, and she wouldn't. And in order to get her to confess anything, they took her parents and sent them to a concentration camp. And this really impacted Hanny, and she was like, I'm done, I'm out. And she would stop working for the resistance right then. And then her parents were released 2 months later. But Hanny lied. She wasn't done working for the resistance. It was too big of a calling for her. And so she dyed her hair black again, and she wears glasses to hide her identity, and she returns to resistance work. She is arrested on March 21st, 1945, while she is distributing illegal communist newspapers, right? Mm-hmm. So she's, and that is illegal in and of itself, but that actually was just a cover. She was transporting secret documents for the resistance while she was having this cover of giving out this communist newspaper. So she had her hair black, glasses on. They didn't know who she was. And they interrogated her. They tortured her. They gave her solitary confinement. And she wouldn't admit who she was until her hair started growing out. And they could see her red roots. And she was identified by her red roots. Truce, her friend, went disguised as a German nurse to try to free her. And she went in and she was like, hey, listen, she needs to be going to this. She needs to get a medical examination. And so Truce, disguised as a German nurse, is like crying, trying to get her friend out. But it was too late because Hanny was executed by the Nazis. Mm. And what makes it all that more tragic is it was 3 weeks before the end of the war when Hanny was executed. There is a story of her execution in which they take her to the execution site and the person who is intending to shoot her grazes her ear. And there is a story of her saying, I shoot better. And then she was delivered a final shot and executed. I don't know if this is, there's some evidence that she did or didn't say it. I like to think that she said it because it's a big fuck you and go off Hanny Shaft. She went on to be the symbol of a symbol of resistance. May 5th, 1945, the Germans surrendered and liberated the entire country. After the war, they were able to find a mass grave site where it had 422 members of the resistance. 421 of those bodies were men and one woman, Hanny Shaft. She was reburied in an honorary cemetery. Two of her executioners were convicted of war crimes. One of them was executed and the other was not. And there was some political, you know, the person determining whether they should be executed, they had a change of heart and they said, I don't think we should be executing. But one of them was. But what's interesting is she was celebrated as this icon, but because of her ties to the Communist Party of the Netherlands, her popularity decreased. In fact, they were trying to do a commemoration of her grave, but that was forbidden in 1951. Things have changed, and since then, schools have been named after her. Meanwhile, Truce and Freddy, they survived the war, but that was not, you know, as much as you survive the war, the scars and the trauma of the war lived with them for many, many, many years for the rest of their life. They talk about having PTSD. They suffered severe nightmares. They would scream and fight in their sleep. They also look back at Hanny's diaries and they see that she probably also was suffering from PTSD and depression during the war, just from her letters, from her writing. What's interesting is these young women at the time of the war did so much work and did so much to help the resistance in the Netherlands. And in many cases, the Netherlands failed to properly recognize their achievements and sidelined them as communists. Truce ended up, she helped establish the National Hanny Shaft Foundation. Freddy was a board member. Truce went on to get married. She got married right away, like 1945, Truce gets married. She ends up having four kids, the oldest of which she names Hanny after her friend Hanny in the war. And she lived a life very publicly. She went on to speak at universities and schools about wars, anti-Semitism, tolerance, and indifference. She writes a book called Not Then, Not Now, Not Ever. She also pursued art. She was a sculptor. She was a painter. In 1967, she did get recognized as righteous among the nations. In 1998, she was invested as an officer of the Order of Orange Nassau for her services during the war. And in 2014, both her and her sister were awarded the Mobilization War Cross by the Dutch Prime Minister for their acts of resistance during the war. She ended up dying at the age of 92 in 2016.
Oh my God.
She had dementia towards the end of her life, but she lived a very, very long life. And Freddie, she was married. She had three children and she lived a more secluded life. She lived, she lived a little bit more privately than her sister, and she focused her energy on her family. And she gave an interview in 2016 before her sister died. And I do want to read it because it's so good. And I think you can kind of get a little bit of her vibe, and I think you'll appreciate it. It's with Vice, and it says, "I understand we don't have a lot of time for the interview." Freddie says, "That's right. I'm meeting some people to play Scrabble at too. I do that twice a week. You can't let people down if you've agreed to join. Do you win often? No comment. What is it like for you to remember the war on Remembrance Day? How do you wake up on a day like today? I do feel a bit of dread, and it's even worse today because I have to go to the dentist this afternoon. I'm not looking forward to that. Are you going somewhere for the Remembrance Day ceremonies? Yes, to Jmuden. People lay wreaths there, including one in my name, and I get to sit in the front row amid all the notables. What do you think about during the 2 minutes of silence? Nothing. I just shut off my thoughts completely, and then I think about the fact that a lot of people have fallen. I remember how people were taken from their homes. The Germans were banging on doors with the butts of their rifles. That made so much noise, you'd hear it in the entire neighborhood. And they would always yell. It was very frightening. Which paper is this interview for, by the way? It's for Vice, an online magazine. I see you have a computer, so yes, but I don't get internet. My children think it's best if I don't go on the internet. Truce worked through her war trauma partly with art that she made. How did you cope? By getting married and having babies. And I often babysat Truce's children as well, because she was very busy. She'd visit Hanny a lot, the mother of Hanny Shaft. I have always been a little jealous of her because she got so much attention after the war, but then I just think, I was in the resistance as well. You know what I'm going to do now? What? Make a sandwich and have a cup of tea. I've been up since 6. In 2018, after a couple of heart attacks, Freddie died at the age of 92 like her sister. It was one day before her 93rd birthday. And so I wanted to tell you the story of Freddie Overstegen, and Hanny Shaft and their efforts during World War II.
What a cool story.
Isn't that cool? I mean, I also, it's worth noting, I think, that, you know, sometimes you feel powerless, and if these young women could help in some way, they did. And so if that inspires you, go forth and help.
My story is a story that I got from The Cut that was in the news this week. So I wonder if you read it. It's a really crazy story by Lauren Smiley. And it happened in Beale City, which is a really small farming community in... I forget where.
Beale City, Iowa.
Oh, okay.
Is it? I don't know. Maybe. I'm like making that up. But Beale City? Let's see if I'm right. I want to see if I'm right. Damn it. Michigan. Fuck.
Damn it. So close.
So close. according to Quinn, close. Because Quinn's geographical knowledge.
So it's the fall, and we're dealing with a couple of 7th graders, Owen McKenney and Ashley Licari. They're in school together. They've got little crushes on each other. They both do sports. Ashley does softball and basketball. And Owen's like, I like you. And they have like a super 7th grade conversation where they're like, I don't know, should we go out? I don't know, I guess, whatever. Like, you know, and they start to date. Owen's family, his parents, Jill and Dave McKenney, have super tight ties to the neighborhood, to the community. They've been there forever. They started dating in 7th grade. And Ashley's parents are more seen as like the new people in town, Sean and Kendra Licari, because they just moved there a couple of years ago. And it's such a small, tight-knit community that if you didn't grow up there, it's kind of got like a new kid on the block vibe. Sean, Ashley's dad, seems like a really nice guy. He takes Ashley hunting. He goes to her games. He coaches her teams. He's like sounds like a really sweet pea. And he works at a shop, like a car shop, I think. And the mom is like in charge of everything, like the finances. She's like the one that oversees everything, schedule, money. The vibe I was getting from the article was that they're sort of having trouble keeping up with the Jones. They want to like make as much money as people in the neighborhood do. And if everybody goes on like we go on vacation to this place, they're like, us too, we do too. Like, you know, like they're trying to fit in, they're trying to keep up. But it sounds like it's difficult because Sean at work will tell the guys he works with, oh my God, we've had like such a string of bad luck. Like we missed our house payments because someone in New Mexico stole our identities. Isn't that crazy? And everyone's like, that's so crazy. And he's like, yeah, that's what my wife says. And then he's like, oh, our truck got repossessed. It's so crazy. It was because of a scammer. And they're like, whoa, that's really crazy. And then like they write a check for a condo that they rented for a vacation and the check bounces. And the mom is like, oh my God, we definitely got hacked again. And it just, it feels like there's like a lot of moments where they're spending money and the money's not there. And Kendra, who's in charge of the money, is like, the money is there. Somebody tricked us. And Sean feels like he's like, okie dokie. But I think there's whispers. Like, I just get the vibe that Sean keeps saying things like that. And you're like, huh, that happens to you guys a lot. Weird money stuff. Kendra is one of those cool moms. I think of like Amy Poehler in Mean Girls, but yeah, I don't think it's sure. that level, but she definitely is like gossiping with the other girls. And she's like, I feel like when that's she's at cool. the softball game, she's like, hey, you guys, like talks to all the kids. She seems to be really excited about Owen and Ashley's relationship because it brings her close to Jill and Dave, who are sort of not statusy, but like they're like really part of the community. And if they can all like go to games together and, you know, do pizza night together, it feels like she's getting a lot out of that relationship. A few weeks after the couple, this young couple starts dating, there's a weird moment where Owen and Ashley get a nasty bullying text that's like, Ashley's didn't get invited to this community party for Halloween. Just like teasing and mean. It rubs them both the wrong way. They don't know who sent it. It's anonymously sent. They can't figure it out. It bothers them, but it doesn't matter because the woman that gets accused of not inviting her is like, she is invited. Everything ends up fine. And then nothing happens on that front for a year, and they're still dating. But a year after this original bullying text, a bunch of bullying texts start to come in to both of their phones. Again, they can't figure out from who. It's like burner phone vibes, like different numbers or maybe apps that change your number. I don't really know how all that stuff works, but it's texts that sound like it's from a girl that likes Owen. And there are things that are like, he doesn't want anything to do with you. He thinks you're annoyed and you're an ugly ass bitch and wishes you would leave him the fuck alone. Why do you think he's on his phone all the time texting me? You didn't get invited to sleep with him. I did. I'm spending the night with him. I'm sharing a bed with him, not you. And so Ashley's like, Owen, are you like they're like in eighth grade. It's like, are you dating somebody else? Like that's like having sex with you? Like what's going on, Owen? Like, and he's like,
you're 12.
You're 12. Oh my God.
So they're 12 years old. Jesus.
They're 12 years old and this bully is going after them. And this bully is like, has like a weird vibe with them where she's, the bully is texting things like talking about the upcoming homecoming dance and saying, could this be the end of the AKA golden couple with the relationship everyone idolizes? Which is so weird because like, it's like weird, they're complimenting them, but they're like underhanded. And then they're saying things like,
but it also feels so seventh grade. Like I remember in seventh grade, I remember a couple that was like the golden couple and you're like, they're gonna get married. They're so in love. Like, right. like it's so hyperbolic and so like, it's so intense.
Oh my God. It's so funny you say that. One of the texts said, you're the definition of a perfect couple and will be the forever couple that gets married. Some of us don't want to hear it anymore.
What did the kids say? They agreed.
Griff said, yes, I can. Griff's part of it. Griff's part of the story
Griffin's
now.
Griffin's like, yes, it can be the perfect couple. I believe in you, Griff.
It's so constant. It strains these kids to a point where they end up breaking up because it's like their whole life becomes like completely about these texts. And yeah. It's so over the top. And it's like they go from like, I don't care to like, leave us alone to like, Ashley's like a wreck. She's crying all the time. But the bully doesn't stop after they break up. And everyone knows they broke up, obviously. And the bully is like goading her, writing things like, maybe you shouldn't have picked cross country over him. You proved he isn't important to you. We were there, though. You don't get with him in bed. You don't sneak out with him. You fucking dress awful. Ain't no guy want that. It's just like, leave me alone. We broke up. Like, if it was Owen you wanted, fuck right off.
Have him. Have him. He's so yours.
The bully clearly goes to school with them, knows a lot about what's going on in the building, makes fun of stuff Ashley wears to school. Like, at one point after the breakup, she wears a shirt he, like, gave her, his varsity shirt or something, and they're, like, teasing her about it. Mm. And they're calling her, like, an anorexic that wasn't good enough to make JV. So they, like, know that she didn't make, like, this team. They just know things. So she's having a really hard time. She's really into sports. The mom goes into the captains and is like, she's super distracted, like, because of these text messages. So, yeah. Like, be gentle on her today. Like, it's really hard for her to compete when she's getting, like, bombarded. And because this is happening, Kendra's, like, showing up at all the games, trying to protect her, and also letting the other parents know, like, this is what's happening with this bully. She works from home, so she comes and checks in on Ashley a lot. When Ashley gets made fun of, Ashley calls her mom and is like, the bully's making fun of me. And she's like, do you want me to bring you a change of clothes? Like, she's really trying to help. Oh, and
that's such a helpless place as a mom. I mean, what do you do?
Yeah. Both the moms are in this place because it's Owen's still getting texted as well. So Jill and Kendra, even though their kids broke up, are still being friendly. And, you know, Kendra was really sad when they broke up because, like I said, she really liked being a part of, like, this community and going everywhere with both the families. And yeah. So they still try to support each other. And, like, right when they break up, Jill and Dave, Owen's parents, are like, we can still be friends, like, to Kendra and Sean. And they're like, yeah, yeah, totally. So, and the text kind of fuel that a little bit because they're, like, showing each other what the texts are that come in and being like, who is doing this? And they both are like, we have to figure out who this is. And sometimes when the texts are really bad, Jill will call Kendra and be like, I feel like if Ashley's in her room, you need to check on her. Like, it's the vibe of, like,
God,
are these kids getting pushed to the brink? They're strategizing. They're trying to armchair detective who it is. But it's also kind of sad because in the middle of armchair detectiving it, Kendra will be like, hey, Jill, do you think the kids will ever get back together? Jill will be like, I don't think so, but
they're,
I don't know.
12.
So Jill's like, hey, I think we got to, like, escalate this. We've met with the principal. We've talked to the school. I think we should need to meet with the sheriff. And This is January of 2022. And Kendra's like, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So they're going to meet with the sheriff. Now, the other ways that they're getting involved with their kids' phones, like, they're getting obsessed as parents.
Yeah.
So Jill will sometimes call the numbers that text the phone and try to call them from different apps, like, try to figure out who's behind it. Sometimes she'll see his phone and he'll have gotten a nasty text and she'll reply on it, like, as him, and write things like, kind of pathetic, you keep hiding behind fake numbers and repeating this over and over. At one point, because they think that it might be this girl, Chloe, Jill texts Chloe pretending to be her son and says, if this is you, be honest. And then Chloe, who's so pissed that her friend Owen is accusing her, then, like, FaceTimes Owen, and Owen's like, what? I didn't send that text.
Drama.
So then it's starting drama between the parents and their own children because They're getting involved. Ashley doesn't feel like she has friends anymore. She's, like, only talking to her mom. She's totally heartbroken. Kids are describing her as, like, a shadow person, a ghost. She's just, like, walking dazed through the hallways, scared to speak because she doesn't know who's doing it to her. So it gives her this feeling of, what if it's a group of people doing it to me? And so she's just, like, sitting next to her mom at all her tournaments, like, lost her boyfriend, totally not talking to friends. Like, it's really dark for her. The suspect that the moms have settled on, Chloe Wilson, is a freshman who did make varsity. And she and Owen had on again, off again crushes that they admit to that school year that this is happening. And there's this thing called OK to Say, which is a tip line for threats to students. Mm-hmm. And Chloe has been called in by other people. It's a tattletale line, and she's been tattled on. She often says, bruh, and so does the person that sends the texts. So they're mm-hmm. like, is it Chloe? It might be, because this person has talked about having police to defend them, and Chloe's dad is a police sergeant. So they're like, And Kendra is like, okay, one time Ashley's Snapchat got hacked, and when I called the social network, they said it came from Broomfield Township, which is where Chloe lives. Also, one time the text had a 906 area code, which when we got the text, Chloe was in that area snowmobiling with her family. So they have all these clues, and they're like, it's got to be Chloe. Word gets out, and Police Sergeant Craig and his wife, Tammy, sit their daughter, Chloe, down and are like, are you doing this? Are you this bully? And she bursts into tears and is like, absolutely not. I would never, ever do that. My friends have been asking me. I know that the school thinks it's me. Owen and Ashley think it's me. I got so sick of this, of being accused of this, that one day I just gave Owen my phone for the whole day just so he'd know, like, I'm not the one doing this. And dad looks through the phone and is like, I'm actually going to like bring it to the cops and download it. And he does.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's clean. It ain't my kid. Like, yeah. It ain't Chloe. When they show the principal before they go to the cops and they take it to the principal and they show him the whole history of these bullies' texts, what strikes the principal is that the start of the texts are full sentences. You didn't get invited to sleep with him. I did. And then he says the later texts start to get more abbreviations in them. Like,
the police is, the principal is like looking at these?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the principal's like, okay. And then later it starts being like RN for right now, WTF, sorry, not sorry, but it abbreviated. He's like, it feels like it started in full sentences and then it went, like, it's almost like two different people, or that it was like, it sounds more adult and then it starts to sound more kid. Like, he's just trying to pick up on anything. And he's like, he's the principal, like, mobilizes. The principal's like, I want all the teachers looking at the way kids are using their phones in class. Like, should we take the phones away from the kids? And the parents are like, don't take the phones away from the kids. We live in a world with school shootings. You can't take our phones away from our kids. We want to be able to get in touch with them during the day. So
Jesus Christ. Everyone's like, it's like one or the other. Either affect their mental health because they're on phones and on social media and texting and get bullied, or worry about your kids getting shot up at a school. What a wonderful country we live in. And I'm proud to be an American.
So this principal is so on it. But the women are like, Jill and Kendra are like, can we talk to the whole girls basketball team about this? And he's like, no, I don't really want you guys addressing the team. It feels like it's emotional and inappropriate. But we can do this other idea you have that is a sting operation where you think that Ashley's getting stuff stolen and maybe it's from the bully. So we're going to like place an Ashley item, her shoes, and we're going to like watch them. We're going to surveil her shoes. And they do. And like nothing happens. And eventually like a janitor comes and takes them and puts them in the lost and found. So they're like, well, that didn't work. But because the principal had surveilled the shoes, which they had put in the gym, he had tons of footage from that day in the gym. And so he's watching the footage and he's like, one weird thing is Kendra. She's on her phone the whole game, and not just her phone. She has two phones. Kind of weird. She said one's work phone, one's a personal phone.
Wait, and Kendra is...
Kendra is the one getting bullied. Or Kendra's the mom of Ashley, the one getting bullied.
Okay.
So then the sheriff goes to Chloe, the suspect, and her family and says, I was given these messages that Kendra sent me. This is from the bully. These are like screenshots of messages that the bully had sent. And what's weird is there's a Snapchat DM with someone named Chloe. And Chloe's like, it's not me. You can make a fake Snapchat. That's not that weird. And then Chloe looks at it and she goes, oh, but something is weird about this. And he's like, what? And she's like, some of the things the fake Chloe is saying are real things that I have said. And he's like, what do you mean? And she's like, okay, I wanted Ashley. This is so middle school to do this. I love it. I wanted Ashley to know that I'm not flirting with Owen, that I'm like not trying mm-hmm. to take him. Mm-hmm. So one time mm-hmm. Owen and I had a conversation and I recorded it. And then I sent the recording of it to Ashley to yeah. prove to her, this is how we talk behind your back and it's not salacious and I'm not talking mm-hmm. shit about you and I'm not trying to hit on him. I wanted to know how you interact. But phrases that were in that conversation that Chloe remembers coming out of her mouth are then coming out of fake Snapchat Chloe's mouth in the chat. And she's like, that doesn't make any sense.
I don't like that.
And Tammy is like, Tammy's Chloe's mom. And she's like, I gotta say, the Kendra thing's rubbing me weird. She would know what you said because Ashley would have showed it to her. And she's had a problem with you, my daughter. She's had a problem with me. She's made my blink go off a million times. And now this weirdness. So she and her cop husband, Craig, are talking about it. And they go to the sheriff and they're like, this is really a stretch, but hear us out. Keep an eye on the mom. Keep an eye on Kendra. The bullying does not stop. It's getting Salem witch trial in the school.
To her own daughter.
Owen is having a total breakdown. He's going to his mom in tears being like, you're my parent. You have to make this stop. She's in tears. Imagine your kid telling you that. And you're like, I can't. Like, Ashley is devastated. She's totally alone. Chloe is devastated. There's all these rumors she's doing it. There's all this gossip about her being their best suspect. So everyone's in a really bad place. And then the turning point is that the Mid-Michigan Computer Crimes Task Force gets involved. And they're the people that know what the fuck they're doing. So Jill sends the guy looking into this. His name's Peter. She goes, Peter, here's the newest numbers that the bully has texted from. One was used on Easter Sunday at about around 6:30 in the afternoon. And he uses some kind of Tracy thing. You know science. Me. I know science. There's a network IP address that he can figure out
yeah.
that it's out of Ann Arbor and the Detroit area. There's another to a server that is in the Beale schools. That means someone is texting from inside, from using the school's
IP.
Yes. So they're like, okay, that is helpful to know what's coming from the school. While this is all getting figured out, Jill is picking up on some weird shit. Some examples. Months after the kids have broken up and they're talking about the bully, Kendra will be like, hey, is Owen dating Chloe? And she'll be like, don't ever ask me about what Owen is. Like, she gets really defensive where she's just yeah. like, that's none of your, like,
that's not
don't do that. And it like rubs her wrong. Dave, Owen's dad, is driving one day and sees Kendra parked half a block from school looking down, like in her car, looking mm-hmm. down at something. She looks up, no big deal, not anything he would have thought yeah. of, but she looks up and sees him and waves, then calls Jill, the wife. And she's like, hey, I just saw your husband. I was pulled over because actually I had a cup of coffee. I spilled it in my lap and I just had to pull over. I had to pull over to clean it. It's not weird. I'm not being weird. You're being weird. What? And
I'm so bummed right now. I feel bad. This story makes me feel
ill.
Bad.
Ill. Hey, you know what should make you feel worse?
Oh, God.
In November, the bully said to Ashley that Owen said his life would be better if you were dead. Then seemed to feel bad because half an hour later wrote, sorry, I shouldn't say dead. That was too far. And that's in November. But by May, months after that, the bully writes in all caps, kill yourself now, bitch. The next week.
Oh, my God.
Peter.
Oh, my God.
Peter hears back from Verizon about the IPs. And one of the numbers that connected, that was connected to the like fake burner number is Kendra's number. Mm-hmm. Like basically they trace it to Kendra. Done. So the sheriff goes to Kendra. There's a search warrant. They're like, you're being investigated as a cyber bully. Classically, she denies. And very quickly, they're like, Kendra, we know that it's you. And she's denying it. And then they're like, Kendra, we know, like, we, like, it's not an assumption. Like, we figured it out. And they're like, why'd you do it? And she's like, well, I wasn't the original. It just that when it first happened, I just saw how it made everybody rally around us. And it just got out of hand. I guess I was just really stressed about money.
Take her daughter away. Take a daughter away from her. Her daughter should not be raised.
She's like,
I
was just super, super stressed. So I did this. And they're like, because remember I said they did get one text and then a year went by. She's like, she wasn't the person that sent that weird invitation text thing. But she like stewed. She like kept thinking about it. And it's just, okay. So they call Ashley. They call Sean, the dad. He runs home and he tells the police, he's like, just so you guys know, my wife has three phones and she's told me excuses of why, but you need to find the third. And they do. And they find it in a log pile outside their house that like she had stashed when she was getting like taken in. They figure out Kendra hasn't worked in over a year. She's been faking work calls in front of her family to pretend she was. They found out that they were getting evicted and didn't know that they were evicted because she told them it was because the house's foundation had cracked. Everything is crumbling. She's lying about it. And she's the bully. She's the cyber bully.
It's crazy to me. Like all of that is not understandable at all. But I like the idea of like your life falling apart and lying to your family. Like, I get it. I don't get it, but I like I have compassion for that. The idea that you are texting to your child and causing
that
her
she's
harm.
Ugly, that she should be sleeping, she should be having sex with her boyfriend to keep him,
the fact that she should kill herself, like the fact that they're talking about self-harm to her child is like, that is so
beyond
dangerous. That is so, well, like, you are playing with fire. So like, that is so
Ashley
dangerous.
Leaves. She doesn't finish school that year. She does the rest of school online by herself.
No.
Yes,
my God.
Because how could you even, Kendra, I mean, and Sean divorces Kendra. She pleads guilty on two counts of cyber stalking. She's like blames
to her own fucking daughter. Like,
and in
what
court,
a
she's
monster.
Like, it's depression, it's anxiety. I was sexually abused as a child, and I repressed it, and I was in crisis. The
right.
judge,
all of those things can be justifiable. Like, you did this to your daughter. Your daughter is not safe in your care.
It's so dark.
Does she have any custody of her daughter? Is she
no,
are they gone?
No.
Good,
no.
Thank God. That's the most important.
The judge gives her 19 months. She's out now. And she just talks about like liking the feeling and having it get out of hand and that she would still be doing it if she hadn't been caught. And she's really glad she got caught. But
fuck off.
It feels like she did it because it created this bond between the families. And when she felt the relationship was threatened, she wanted to bring them closer. It's just interesting because she kept saying to Jill the whole time, like, is it because of the bully that they broke up? And it's like, yes. And it's this thing where it's like, you did the thing you were scared of. Like, you actually broke these kids up. Not that it was like they needed to be together forever, like seventh grade, but it was this thing of like, she wanted to be the one that, okay. Remember Mark Feldman that we talked to? He's the Munchausen's by proxy expert that we talked to.
Oh, yes, of course.
So he talks about this a lot, Munchausen by internet. And this is what experts think is going to be the new Munchausen because it's so much easier. You don't need to physically hurt anybody to do it. Yeah. And everybody has access. And you can do it constantly and your victim won't die. So, you know, unless they kill themselves, which clearly this was like really risky behavior. We're really lucky that Ashley made it through this, frankly.
Yeah.
But it is the thing of like, she was hurting her daughter and her daughter was calling her and saying, Mom, the bully's here again. Like, she was making fun of Kendra's outfit or making fun of Ashley's outfit. And then she was bringing her a new outfit to school. Look at when this happened, seventh grade. This is when girls start to pull away from their moms. And she created a situation where it was the opposite. She was sitting next to her daughter at every game. Ashley didn't have anyone but her mom. And A friend says Ashley had started to think her mom might be the bully in the last month before her mom got caught. Like, things were clicking for her as well. So this was all a house of cards that was about to fall. I do want to tell you that Ashley went back to school for her junior year. She and Owen do not talk. She has a friendship with Owen's sister. They don't discuss it.
Yeah.
And Lifetime released a movie based on this called Mommy Meanest with Lisa Rinna as
Kendra. That makes sense to me.
There's a documentary scheduled to drop this year on Netflix.
That is an insane story. And I think what's so crazy is I think hearing her, how close her daughter was to her, I'm sure it gave Kendra some sense of control that she can continue to do this because she knows her daughter would talk to her.
Mm-hmm. And anytime you feel like you don't know what's going on in the building, it's like you suddenly are in the building. Like you've cast yourself in this role.
Not even that. I think it gave, like, I think there's that. In addition, I think that her mom was like, listen, my daughter's okay. I can say this to her because I know she'll talk to me. Like it gave
I can
her,
fix
like,
it. I can like hurt it, her. I can fix it. I can hurt
exactly.
her. I can fix
so
it.
So it's not. So it's okay. So
it's the like, same it's, as Munchausen's. It's like,
yes,
let me hurt you so that you then need me to heal you.
That's fucking gnarly. That's disgusting. That's vile.
I mean,
ugh, a hot place in hell. A hot, hot, hot place in hell.
So I believe Ashley's name was changed for the article. Good. But I cannot imagine being at that tender age.
No.
The thing and is, having like, your mom be so an puberty, absolute sociopath.
Hormones. Like life, like junior high is hard enough as it is tough enough as it is that like your safe place, your home, your mom is your bully.
So scary.
God, it's disgusting.
Well, we went really long.
We went long. We needed a long one. We've had some shorties. We needed a long one.
All right. Thank you for this long episode and for hanging in there. We'll be back next week with
Truly
Darkly.
Creepily.